Here today for what we regard as a special event featuring three noted lawyers, two who have flown 8,000 miles to be here, the other who only had to come from upper New York State but whose plane was diverted, and hopefully he will arrive before the program comes to an end and he can make his remarks, because as you know, Macau, Matua loves to be provocative and turn the screw at every opportunity. Today's topic, as you know, is Kenya. Is political reform possible? The movement for political reform in Kenya, as many of you in the room know well, is not new. It dates back to 1990 or even earlier, perhaps, depending on how far you want to go back. Some would say even to the 1960s. But beginning in 1990, there were protests leading to a cutoff of aid by the international community. There was then the move to multi-party politics with the repeal of Article 2A of the Kenyan Constitution. Since then, we've had four multi-party elections in Kenya. The first three, each, or the second and third, were better than their predecessors. But we learned that elections alone do not a democracy make. And after the election of 2007, all of us, I think, know what happened to Kenya as it was ripped apart in the aftermath of post-election violence following the failed administration of that election. Along the way, the issue of constitutional reform has been a permanent issue of Kenyan political life and one that has been the focus of attention in between the election cycles. Early proposals by the Kenyan Law Society in the early part of the 90s, and then, as we know, the Constitution of Kenya Review Commission in 2002, the BOMAS fiasco, the referendum of 2005, and then, of course, the 2000 election itself. Then we have the attempt to repair the damage of 2007 and the agreement of February 28, 2008. And one of the expectations is that that power-sharing agreement would at least buy time for a meaningful review and production of a new Kenyan constitution that would, among other things, address permanently the balance of power between the executive and the legislative branch and provide for some measure of devolution, the precise form of which would be negotiated and hammered out in the process. And that would also address long simmering issues such as land and the like. And then, of course, the Waki and Crigler commissions. And we have, in fact, a staff member of that commission here with us today, I believe. Suzanne, where are you? Nope, she's not here. In any case, people in the room who are well familiar with the Waki Commission and its report and the supposed eight names that have been given to Kofi Annan to pass on to the ICC, and then the Crickler Commission, which has resulted at least an initial attempt at reestablishing the Electoral Commission, but a commission which many believe is short on competency and capacity. And in the meantime, the clock is ticking towards the 2012 election. So within that context, I think it's safe to say that many in this room who were cautiously optimistic as recently as a year ago share varying degrees of pessimism as to whether political reform is really possible in Kenya. And for that reason, we thought we'd bring these principles together because all three have sound track records on reform if one goes back all the way to the 1990s. Martha Karua, who was a member of Parliament for Gichugu constituency and an advocate of the High Court, has been in politics since the early 1990s. She was first elected to the National Assembly in 1992 and has been re-elected ever since. In that first election, which I remember well, she was really the first woman to gain a seat competitively. Very difficult race. It established her bona fides as a politician. She's now announced that she's running for the presidency in 2012. She was appointed by President Kibaki as the Minister of Justice and Constitutional Affairs in last year, and yet she resigned on April 1st from that position, stating that one of her reasons for leaving the cabinet was that she was dissatisfied with the pace of reform. And yet, there are many of us, I think, here in Washington who regard her somewhat of the Iron Lady last year in the negotiations and the protracted stalemate that brought the aftermath of the election to the close. Paul Mwite was a member of Parliament, served three distinguished terms, also entering the National Assembly in the election of 1992, former president of the Law Society of Kenya, a noted lawyer, graduate of the University of London Law School, a political maverick and yet an insider at the same time, one of the people I always try to see when I visit Kenya because I can gain more from Paul in terms of a political education in an hour than for many others in 10 times that amount. He is still the leader, despite his defeat in the last election, of the Safina Party, which holds five seats in the Parliament. And our last speaker, who we hope will arrive before the hour is out, or before the 2 hours are out, Makau Matua, Dean of the College of Law at the State University of New York at Buffalo and Distinguished University Professor in the State University of New York system, a lawyer, degrees from Harvard, was tightly involved with the human rights program at Harvard for many years before moving to Buffalo about 5 years ago and becoming dean last year. He writes frequently on Kenyan affairs in the Kenyan papers, also op-eds in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, and others. So without further ado, we're going to turn the podium over to Honorable Martha Karua. Welcome to Washington, and we look forward to your remarks.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Now, to answer the question whether reforms are possible in Kenya, one has to look at the context in which we are asking that question. This is the President Kibaki's second term, having come in 2002 December on a platform of reforms. And quite a number of significant reforms did take place during the first term, 2003 to 2007, mainly in the way government was run, resulting in improved growth rates, improving infrastructure, and improving services to the people. But following the failed referendum, there was a setback politically. Hate campaign took place during the referendum. In retrospect now, one realizes that as government then, we did not address the issue sufficiently. We went to the elections again with the hate campaign continuing. And after the election results, there was post-election violence. Or shall I say violence started during the period of elections, but reaching a peak after the results were announced. Now, after the elections and after the setting in of the coalition government, as a person who's been in government until 2 months ago, I can say that there has been some reforms, but also there has been increasing reluctance to reforms. So this question is being asked in the context of a government that on policy says it's a reform government. That's the reason why the coalition government came together. to be able to push certain fundamental reforms, including overhauling the Constitution. But at the moment, we are increasingly seeing the government becoming reluctant, a reluctant reform partner. Certain reforms are fundamental, and if they don't take place, then Kenya may be once again drifting towards a situation where there can be another explosion of violence and a disintegration of the state. I've said certain reforms are absolutely necessary. One of them is overhauling the electoral laws, setting up a new electoral commission. We passed a constitutional amendment in December last year, which abolished the entire electoral commission, with the hope that Kenyans, during constitutional review, will define what sort of an electoral body they want. So currently we have an interim independent electoral commission whose lifespan will be 2 years. It started in February this year. They are embarking on a nationwide fresh registration of voters and setting up an election machine that is devoid of the contamination that characterized the last electoral commission. This being an interim body, it goes without saying that we need, as a nation, to dialogue and agree on the sort of body we want, and that can only come about with the passage of an appropriate clause in the Constitution. And since the constitutional review process began also in February, we are hoping that we shall be able to generate sufficient will within the country to complete the constitutional review in order to enable this body to come in. We need reforms of our court. The violence came about because one party, the ODM, felt they could not take their grievances to court. They felt that they didn't have any trust in the court. It means that we need to overhaul our court system. That, again, can only be done with constitutional review. Overhaul the way business is run in the courts. That was one of the reasons that, the immediate reasons that led to my resignation. Continuing appointment of judges without proper criteria, and in the course of it, appointing judges who are known to be corrupt. I thought that was the worst thing that could happen to a government that has committed itself and where the principals have signed to carry out reforms. Our judiciary has a horrible backlog of cases, and even the few cases that get determined, many are attended by allegations of bribery. It is therefore absolutely essential that we not only have a good electoral system, but also a mechanism of resolving electoral disputes. We are about to set up an interim body, interim independent constitutional court, which will also last for 24 months, like the electoral commission, and an independent boundaries commission to help us review our electoral boundaries. You may recall that there was allegations of rigging on the President Kibaki's side. One of the reasons that was the perception is because the vote counting delayed in the Mount Kenya region. The Mount Kenya region had been denied additional constituencies for the last 2 decades during the Moi era. So the constituencies are bigger, generally bigger than in the rest of the country, not in size, but in the number of votes. And when you count votes manually, it means whereas others can count within the first day, in Central Province and Mount Kenya area, it takes 2 days. If the candidates are too many, it will take a little longer to finish the counting. So unless if there is boundaries review, then certain areas will be overrepresented, whereas other areas will be underrepresented, which in itself is a form of rigging. And that is why President Kibaki's party had less seats, yet more votes than the other side. So there are certain fundamental reforms that are necessary, and this was noted in the Kriegler Commission. Other reforms that are absolutely necessary are police reforms. An efficient police force would not have allowed the violence to escalate. But the police fell prey to partisan grandstanding, just like the politicians, and there were areas that the police would act in a biased manner. There is a lot of corruption in the police force. There is also no clear criteria for promotions, and there are lots of allegations of bribery. A lot of extrajudicial killings have occurred in the last 2 years. I must say that before the referendum, the police had improved the human rights record and their approach to issues, and our record had considerably improved. But in the run-up to the elections and up to until now, there are cartels within the police that are extortionists and that flout every rule in the book and have been responsible for extermination of many, many young men, especially from the Mount Kenya region, giving them a tag of an outlawed group. So that generalized tag makes every young man from the Mount Kenya region a target. The other human rights abuses in other areas while fighting crime, and instead of apprehending, they arrest. This is not a police force that can ensure security of every Kenyan. If there was tension again during elections, then this is a police force that can lead us to ruin. We therefore need fundamental reforms which were agreed upon by the principals when they endorsed the Waki report, but which now signs are showing that at least part of the government is not willing to implement. I've talked about reforms in the judiciary, reform in the Attorney General's office, and some of these reforms will mean removing those who have headed those institutions. There are certain reforms that cannot go on when those who have superintended over the decline are sitting in those offices. As almost 1.5 years after the post-election violence, most of the perpetrators of the violence have not been prosecuted. Very, very scanty investigations have been carried out, and the few cases in the courts have been thrown out. It means that our criminal justice system is just not functional. And that means the Attorney General's chambers, the police, and the judiciary. And also other cases not related to violence, corruption cases, civil cases, all manner of cases are also facing the same handicap. So we need the wheels of justice in Kenya have ground to a halt, and something drastic is needed to allow this to go on. And without constitutional amendments, then it becomes very, very difficult to carry out those reforms. Therefore, constitutional review is key to all these things. Now, with a reluctant government, how is reform possible? And one, my mind goes back to the 1992, the early 90s, before the return to multi-party politics in 1992. The Moi government was totally anti-reform, but the population wanted reforms. And there was this mobilization of the masses through statements made by the clergy, by the Law Society, where both I and Paul were council members. Paul was the chair. And we were agitating for reforms. The media was carrying those messages, and the entire country went on reform mood. that served to pressurize the government to carry out the necessary reforms. The constitution was amended, reintroducing multipartism and opening the gates for competitive politics. Now, this is the sort of scenario, in my view, that has to be generated once again. The government on its own won't just bring reforms. They will do a few cosmetic things, form task forces, table legislation, and then sabotage it. And I'm saying that with insider's knowledge. And generally give people hope something is happening while doing nothing. So the population, the civil societies, all pro-reform forces need to come together to push those reforms. But unfortunately, civil society is not as strong as it was in the 90s. The religious groups, the main civil society organizations, professional bodies, all these were affected by the divisions that attended the 2007 elections. We are healing and coming together, but we are not there yet. So a lot of work is needed. And those of us who are not quitters will have to burn the midnight oil because we have no other country. Kenya is our only country. So we have to fight for our country to ensure that things happen that will save us from going down. And that means also getting support in that direction from friends. And I think that's where the situation is, that reform is absolutely necessary. It doesn't look like it's going to come easily from the government. And I must say that Parliament is also not showing signs of being a very strong reform institution. There are pro-reform forces within Parliament. But again, the Grand Coalition, because there is hardly any opposition in Parliament. I pride myself with the Secretary General of my party that we are opposition. Because when I resigned, my Secretary General, who was an assistant minister, also resigned. Some of our members have remained in government, but we definitely constitute a two-person opposition. There are other opposition parties, each having one or so persons. We form a strong voice in Parliament, but we don't have numbers. So the question is to cultivate other backbenchers who can support the reform initiative and also link up with those outside Parliament. It's not the sort of situation that one looks forward to, but we are there, and therefore we have to keep on fighting to bring those reforms. I think that, in a nutshell, is the situation. But I must say that, in my view, the fight against corruption has been abandoned by the Grand Coalition government. That, again, was one of my grievances, because my mandate was also, I was responsible for policy on strategies to fight corruption. Also responsible for policy on human rights and governance generally. And these are areas that the government showed they were not interested in. At one stage, I requested the principals to abolish the mandate altogether so that we don't pretend anymore that we are doing anything about governance, about human rights, and about the fight against corruption. At the final stage, I found it was easier to be out, talk about it, and agitate for it from the opposition benches. After all, that's where I had come from. And I have some experience in that. So I will use my experience in government and out of it to ensure that at least I play my role to bring about change in Kenya. Just before I stop, may I correct one detail that I'm not the first woman to be elected. Grace Onyango was the first woman elected in the 70s. There have been several others elected at different times. Maybe if I have to be a first, it could be woman lawyer, but not but not the first to go to Parliament. But we are now 18 or 21 women. 11 elected, 12 elected, and 9 nominated. So we are doing well. When I entered Parliament 15 years ago, we were then 6, the largest number ever up to then. We've now graduated to about 12. And one of the changes we are seeking is to accommodate more women by making parties nominate at least 1/3 of their candidates as women. I head a political party called NAK Kenya. It will be my duty to ensure that we do better than what the law is saying, that we go 50-50. Thank you.
I neglected to mention before we began that the remarks of the two principals up on the stage are on the record. And as Honorable Karua said, my remarks are always on the record, and you can therefore quote anything she said in the last 15 minutes. Honorable Paul Mwite.
I will try to be brief because what I'm looking forward to is the interactive stage where comments come from you and questions so that we can get a sense of the issues you would like us to address. So the comments I'm going to make are in the context of encouraging comments from you, of encouraging interaction. When we talk about reforms, political constitutional reforms, what my mind focuses on is that political and constitutional reforms are not an end unto themselves. They are a means to an end. And the end is the uplifting of the quality of life for a majority of the Kenyan people. That is what I see as the objective for reforms. So what we need in Kenya is a radical restructuring of the socio-economic management of the country so as to bring about that uplifting of the quality of life for a majority of the Kenyan people. We are today talking about a country where 65% of the Kenyan people live on less than a dollar a day. They live below the poverty line. We are talking about a country which is reeling with a debt repayment. Our debt today is well over 1 trillion Kenya shillings. We're talking about a country which is ranked 4th in the world in terms of the gap between the rich and the poor. This 1 trillion debt, what is there on the ground to show for it? The truth is that most of that money has been looted and stolen. It is in the pockets of a few individuals. If you look at the National Debt Register, you will discover that we have borrowed 3 loans for the construction of railway lines. Yet, as everybody in Kenya knows, not 1 kilometer of railway line has been added to the small gauge railway line laid by the British in 1892. You will find that in the last supplementary budget passed by Parliament in April this year, a sum of 200 million Kenya shillings was made available for the repayment of a loan to construct a fertilizer factory that was supposed to have been constructed in 1974. A total of 14 billion has already gone towards the repayment of a non-existent fertilizer factory because we don't have it. Most of these debts are in respect of ghost projects. And as the Honorable Mother Karua says, corruption is and remains endemic in Kenya. So when we talk about constitutional and political reforms, we're talking about reforms to bring in institutions of balances and checks so that this impunity of looting public resources that should have gone towards uplifting the quality of life for a majority of the people can take place. The question is this fundamental restructuring of the manner in which we manage Kenya, these political reforms, institutional reforms, constitutional reforms, are they possible? And I regret to state that in my analysis, they are not possible. Because in order to have these sort of reforms, you must have in place a reformist government, which is headed by genuine reformers, willing to put in place these reforms, not for political reasons, but for the benefit of laying a firm foundation for a majority of the Kenyan people and the generations to come. When you look at the agenda item number 4, which was part of the settlement negotiated by Kofi Annan at Serena, you will find there are 6 items. The first one is the Grand Coalition Government is supposed to undertake constitutional, legal, and institutional reforms. It's number 1. Number 2, tackling poverty, inequality, and combating regional development imbalances. Tackling unemployment, particularly among the youth, is the 3rd one. The 4th one is consolidating national cohesion and unity. And the 5th one is undertaking land reform. The final one is addressing transparency, accountability, and impunity. Now, a quick look, and I don't want to go into names and personalities, a quick look at both the PNU side and its allies and the ODM side, you will quickly find that the beneficiaries of land grabbing since 1963 or their children are the ones now holding key cabinet positions in that government. Are we being realistic in asking them to undertake serious land reforms? You will find that the majority of the grand corruption, together with the impunity that goes in it, are the individuals occupying key cabinet positions, both on this side, PNU, and on the other side. So how can you ask them to implement reforms that are going to address the issue of impunity? You will find that the architects of the post-election violence are the ones occupying key positions on both sides of the political divide. And yet, the international community keeps pressurizing the Grand Coalition government to set up a local tribunal to try the post-election. It will not happen. If it was to happen, it would be stage-managed, it would be ineffective. So one of the benchmarks that I would like to make here is to appeal to the international community, United States of America, Barack Obama government included, to stop pressurizing for the establishment of a local tribunal and to tell Kofi Annan to give that envelope to The Hague immediately. He doesn't need to wait for August. Because if 3 or 4 of the key people at the top files are opened against them by Mr. Ocampo, the Kenyan people will immediately see that the culture of impunity has come to an end. If the top 3 or 4 are actually subjected to investigations by the International Criminal Court, then Kenya will be able to set up a local tribunal to try the perpetrators, the people lower down, the foot soldiers who are taking orders from the others. So all these 6 agenda items in Agenda 4 have to do with transitional justice. And transitional justice, in my view, presupposes a regime change from a dictatorship, from an autocracy, to a reformist government which has got the legitimacy and the mandate of the people and the political will to address past injustices and to punish, where appropriate, those past injustices. So what am I saying? I am saying that the Grand Coalition cannot implement Agenda 4 of the settlement negotiated by Kofi Annan. And therefore, the way forward, and this is the second point I would like to make, the way forward is for that reality, unpleasant as it is, to be appreciated and to be accepted so that new strategies for moving the reform agenda forward can be undertaken. Before the elections, I had the privilege of chairing the Parliamentary Committee on the Administration of Justice and Legal Affairs, and we had pushed a lot for a package of reforms which would have ensured that the elections were free and fair and the results would have been accepted. I believe that if those reforms had been undertaken, the slaughter of the Kenyan people we saw would have been avoided. For example, it cannot be fair that if my friend Honorable Martha Karua is a presidential candidate, that the Constitution should permit her to handpick members of the Electoral Commission, which is going to conduct the elections where she is a presidential candidate. Because even if she wins, she has no right to ask her opponent to accept that she won in free and fair elections. Elections must not only be free and fair, they must be seen to be free and fair. Therefore, the necessity for professionalizing the Electoral Commission, ensuring the integrity and independence of the Electoral Commission, is very, very critical to my mind. Unfortunately, those reforms are not to be. And of course, part of the process is that I had to lose my seat in the process because one of the candidates was from my ethnic community. My ethnic community could not understand why I was making it difficult. Mundu Witu, our man, to win. So, by surprise, I am happy to have paid. So what I'm saying here, and I completely agree with my friend Martha, is that comprehensively reviewing our constitution and undertaking the long-term reforms which are envisaged by Agenda 4 cannot be undertaken by the Grand Coalition government for the reasons I have mentioned, because they are the perpetrators, they are the ones in power. You cannot ask them to set up a genuine Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission to investigate themselves in an impartial manner. So the way forward is to identify a package of reforms to be enacted immediately in order to ensure, first, that if it is necessary to have fresh general elections tomorrow, Kenya can be in a position to conduct those elections whose results will be accepted even by the losers without us going to war. That, to me, is a priority. Back in 1974, during the first republic of the late Jomo Kenyatta, we had an attorney general, one Charles Jonjo. When people were discussing about succession of Jomo Kenyatta, the attorney general came out and intimidated people. And he said, for you to imagine that Kenyatta can die, this is treason. And anybody who, because it was legal nonsense, but he says, anybody who talks about succession is imagining that Kenyatta can die. And I'm going to charge them with treason. And of course, our discussion abruptly came to an end. Nobody else talked about it. But at least today we made some progress. We're talking about a president who escaped, luckily, a helicopter crash the other day. We are looking at a reality where it could be necessary to have elections tomorrow. When the Constitution was amended to bring in the Interim Electoral Commission, I think the amendment also abolished the voters' register. So we're talking about a situation where if anything happened tomorrow, we cannot have elections. When this Serena Accord was being negotiated, I think it did not address what would happen if elections were to suddenly become possible. We have a prime minister who never loses a moment in reminding people how many votes he got vis-a-vis the vice president, Kalonzo Musyoka. Yet the current constitution talks about the vice president will take over for 90 days. And you're asking one Amolo Odinga to begin to call vice president Kalonzo Musyoka, Your Excellency? You're joking. It will not happen. So, to my mind, it's so critical that these reforms which we ought to have in order to make it possible, even the Grand Coalition could collapse tomorrow, we must put in place constitutional, institutional, political, legal reforms that would enable us, would act as a framework within which we can have free and fair elections. And that is not something that can wait until we have a new constitution. And part of the reason why we are not going to have a new constitution, I have a paper I had written for another forum, which I'm going to leave with my friend here, that argues about the reasons. One of them is the land issue, because it's very, very complex. In Coast Province, in Rift Valley Province, and in Central Province. It's very, very complex. We've got issues of devolution, otherwise known as majibo. These are issues that need to be given enough time for consensus to develop around. And there are some other issues that may look innocuous, but they are very, very serious. The inclusion of the Kathy's Court in the Constitution remains very, very contentious. Mother, when I was chairing the Parliamentary Select Committee on the Constitutional Reform, I remember all the Muslim leaders coming just before we went to Bombers One, all of them, closing ranks because they are also divided. They said, when we go to Bombers, that clause that is providing for the Kathy's Court to be in the Constitution, we don't want any debate on it. Hatutaki debate. And I say to one of them, suppose one wants to speak in support. They told me even that we don't want. Ipite ilivyo. It must pass the way it is. And of course, 2-3 weeks later, all the bishops in the churches, the Roman Catholics, the Protestants, they came. And I noticed that they were just telling me they don't want that word in the constitution. It's like mentioning the word Kathy was going to defile them. They were saying that word. And I asked, what word? And it's only one who had the courage to mention Kathy. We don't want that word. I'm not sure the situation has changed. And these are issues that cannot be resolved by a committee of experts. This is an issue that must be resolved and the consensus developed by the stakeholders, which means the Christians and our Muslim brothers and sisters. I know for a fact that if the word, however clever one tries to be, reproductive health rights is not just a debate in the United States, it's also a major debate in Kenya in the context of the new constitution. The evangelicals, the Catholics, and I think the Muslims do not want to hear about the constitution talking about reproductive health rights. When, of course, the women elite want some provision to be made. What is the point I'm making? Let us not tie down a complete review of the constitution or these other fundamental reforms that we are talking about to a package of reforms, because the package of reforms targeting the constitution is what is urgent and necessary. Let us adopt the concurrent principle as we proceed with comprehensively reviewing our constitution, sorting out our historical injustices and what have you. Let's now pick out this package. And Mother summarized very carefully, we need to professionalize the ECK, make it permanent, give them all the powers. We must sort out the issue of our judiciary. We must make a decision on whether we want a parliamentary system or a presidential system. And let us debate also so that we avoid the mistake of entrenching, balkanizing the country by having a hybrid system. We need to address the chapter on representation of the people, and that is the package of reforms you are saying should be enacted now. In the process, for those of you in the diaspora, nobody is any longer opposing the issue of dual citizenship. So that is also an amendment that can go with this minimum reform package that we are talking about. And another smaller one, because the current Kenya constitution, if a Kenyan man marries a non-Kenyan, she has the right to apply to be registered as a Kenyan citizen. The children are automatically Kenyan citizens. Not the opposite. If a Kenyan woman marries a non-Kenyan, and there are many who also then divorce and they're in the country with their children, raising their children as single mothers, but they have to go through a protracted system of naturalization. How do you naturalize? So these are some of the cobwebs that we could also remove. Finally, Joel, give me 2 minutes to ask, how did Kenya arrive at this situation where politics is played on the basis of ethnicity and money? Money that has come from corruption. The only way you can do effective politics, unless mother and others now change it, that you must steal enough from the public coffers and you must whip up ethnic feelings from different ethnic blocks. Both PNU, it's an arrangement of ethnic blocks. So is ODM, if truth must be told. How did we arrive at this? The issue of reforms in Kenya has always been hijacked at the critical moment. First, and I see my friend David Lamp is here and he's got connections with our mother colonial power. The British mistakenly thought that Jomo Kenyatta was part of the Mau Mau. He wasn't. Because in fact, the person who they wanted to send to Britain to take a petition about our land, which had been taken over by the Brits, was one builder who, for one reason or the other, could not have been sent by these nationalists who had nationalist ideals, like George Washington. But Jomo had the luck that because Buta could not go, Buta said the only other person with the king's English is Jomo. And he was sent, and he came back. And the Mau Mau movement by the nationalists was ongoing. If truth must be told, Jomo was saved by the British when they arrested him in 1952, thinking that he was the leader of the Mau Mau. In fact, the Mau Mau War Council had already sat and passed a death sentence on the old man. They were going to hang him or cut his throat, Mungiki's trial. But having been imprisoned, now he became the governizing individual. And because he was never among the nationalists in 1963, he's the one now who went to bed with the chiefs and the sons of the chiefs. You've heard about massacres in Central Province, Mungiki, and what have you. It has its roots in those late 40s, early 50s, the nationalists who fought for independence and who are totally betrayed and sidelined by the First Republic under Jomo Kenyatta, which is the one that started this grabbing and accumulation, naked accumulation, right-wing conservatives. And that's how we've ended up being one, the fourth country in the world in terms of the gap between the rich and the poor, and yet we are a small economy. The Second Republic was the same. Adam Oi, ultra-conservative, accumulation continued. He may not have had the competence of Jomo because Jomo was competent. And there is no difference between the current regime under President Mwai Kibaki. He comes from my own community. Right-wing, conservative, accumulation. He may have done roads here and there. But this money that has been borrowed and stolen, if it had gone to building dams, look at the contradiction in Turkana Pokot, Ukambani, during the rainy season, many people die because of the seasonal rivers that take away buses. The same year, during the dry season, people are dying of hunger. How come we have not used this money to harvest the rainwater and to take electricity there for irrigation and that sort of thing? Right now, in my own analysis, when Mother says that she has noticed that the government of President Kibaki is not keen on these reforms, my own analysis that to my friend, His Excellency Mwai Kibaki, the reform agenda is something to occupy the masses with. His heart is not there, his mind is not there. He's busy arranging succession for one with ideologies like his to take over from him. I thank you. Let's get to the interactive stage. Thank you.
Before we begin the questioning, Martha Carew would like to make a couple of final comments.
Just to observe that even if Ocampo at The Hague opens investigations on the top-level perpetrators in Kenya, Kenya will still need a local tribunal to try the many murderers, rapists, arsonists who cannot be tried at The Hague. And this needs to happen before there can be another election. Otherwise, people will be encouraged to follow the same trends. Also to say that some of the reforms on Agenda Item 4 have actually been partly implemented. The Waki Commission was as a result of those agreements. The Kriegler Commission as a result of it. We abolished the Electoral Commission, but there isn't sufficient will to push them through. The voters' register is, by law, supposed to be put together by the Interim Electoral Commission. And even if elections were called today, I would not be as worried as Paul, because any time elections are called, the Electoral Commission opens the voter register. It's only that this time they would not be opening. They would be calling up people to come and register within a given number of days. So it's still possible. The danger and the crisis we faced was before the appointment of the electoral body, because then there was a vacuum. But now there is a body. There are two by-elections that have been called, and they are starting the registration afresh in those two constituencies. So I just wanted to clarify that that crisis is no longer there. There's only one point that I don't quite see it the same way as Paul, on minimum reforms. Having gone through the constitutional review, and the areas he has mentioned are the areas with contention, then it means that most of the rest of the document can actually go through. So I would not be looking for minimum reform. I would be looking for maximum possible. So that if Kenyans don't agree on an issue, say land, because of vested interest, or any other issue, that issue is retired from the Constitution and is set aside for further negotiations after we enact the package that will have been agreed upon. The timetable is up to March next year. So it is possible to push that package, but I would not describe it as minimum. I would describe it as maximum possible, because the situation of human rights is also critical. So what are you going to leave out? I would only leave out what we don't agree on. But otherwise, you take on board everything else that has been agreed upon. And that is what we are looking for today. And Cathy Scott, some of the contentions that we get in the Constitution are actually a creation of the elite ourselves. Cathy Scott have existed as long as the state of Kenya has existed. They have not offended the Christians in any way. What made the Christians demand that we don't have the Cathy Scott is because our Muslim brothers had started to demand, some of them, for increased mandate for the Cadiz Court to cover civil matters. So now that it is clear that the law must apply to everybody equally except personal law and religious issues, the Cadiz Courts, as they are, I do not see any possibility of leaving them out, because the new constitution brings expectation of expanded rights, not condensed rights. So to tell a Muslim who has enjoyed going to their own court on personal law for the last 40 years that we are going to put a close on it, for me is raising unnecessary controversy. And therefore, we will be trying, at least as individuals, to persuade that it is better we maintain the status quo as far as those courts are concerned to enable us to move forward. I think I would also now leave it to interaction.
Okay. John Harbison.
First of all, thank you both for your comments. They're refreshing and really inspiring. So my question for you both is about process. After the bonus process and how difficult that was, as you all know, what kind of process do you envisage that would lead to a better result than Bowman's did without encountering the same obstacles?
Everybody hear him, because I think the mic was off. Well, who did not hear, first of all? Okay, I guess you were heard. Take two or three at a time, and then we'll... Okay, in the back, please identify yourself.
Thank you. Raymond Muhula, I'm a Kenyan. I just want to thank you for a brilliant presentation. Both of you are champions of reforms in our country, and we are proud of you. I just wanted to ask a question regarding reforms. I'm wondering, why is it that currently sitting members of parliament cannot table legislation that would deal with these issues of constitutional reforms, even without national constitutional referendum? Thank you.
Greg Simpson.
Scro, you mentioned the early 90s. At that time, you had...
Can you please identify yourself?
Gregory Simpkins, Handmaid Sullivan Foundation.
Thank you. You mentioned in the early 90s the movement to restore a multi-party democracy. You had the Forum for the Restoration of Democracy. You had a Democratic Party that I believe you belonged to, which was run by a lot of very honorable young lawyers who were trying to change things. My first question is, what happened to all of those reformers that did exist and did make some change in the early 90s? And the second thing is, by the mid-90s, there were successes in minimizing, you can't really eliminate, cheating in elections. Why did this fall apart so much in the 2007 election when it had reduced vote fraud in earlier elections?
Okay, I think we'll take those.
Now, may I say that what the law now says about constitutional review is that the referendum will be on what has been agreed upon. It is hoped that the referendum will not be used to resolve issues. It will not be a resolution referendum. It will be a constitutive referendum. And why we decided to go the referendum way, Kenyans voted for the constitution and against it in 2005. So they now have this expectation that a new constitution cannot come into place without involving them. So it is a way of involving Kenyans. Let them enact the new document after it has been agreed upon and given to them to see what it is that is being enacted. Greg, you are asking, what happened to all those reformers? They are there, and some have since drifted and are enjoying the trappings of power and have gone where we thought Moi was when we were trying to remove him. So some are no longer interested in reforms. They would rather maintain the status quo. And about cheating in the 2007 elections, Krigler observed that there was widespread cheating by individual candidates. The perception that the electoral commissioners rigged the elections in Nairobi, it's something that goes unsubstantiated, and it's something that was Krigler did not find any evidence of. So the problem was not at the tallying center as thought. Votes were exaggerated by both sides at the various polling stations, not at all of them. But in my view, as a person who was involved and who was at KICC, I also saw nothing untoward. We all waited for the Electoral Commission to announce each candidate's tally. And it's somewhat funny that you accept your own tally, but you refuse the next person's tally without any reason. Just because they have overtaken you, you say that tally is not good. But people, emotions had been whipped up, and people, the propaganda was, if the incumbent wins, then it is rigged. But the truth of the matter is that our electoral machinery had so many leakages that Krigler found, even if he were to recount, it would not indicate accurate results. So we were in a leaking boat for so long, and we had not addressed the issue. And this is the time to address it.
John Hudson, you mentioned, I gathered, some concerns about the process. And I would like to say that those concerns are legitimate in the sense that when you look at the process at the moment, you've got Parliament at the apex, then you've got the Parliamentary Select Committee, then you've got these other organs that have been set up, which are reporting to the Parliamentary Select Committee, and the Parliamentary Select Committee is reporting back to Parliament. It is true that the Act is in process of being amended to put in some reference groups. But the major question is, how are decisions on the contentious issues going to be made? For example, what system of government are we going to have, parliamentary or presidential? Clearly, the Committee of Experts cannot make that decision on behalf of the Kenyan people. There needs to be a lot more widespread consultations for that decision to be made, including an issue, are we going to include the Cathy's courts or not? And I quite agree that this is something that has been there since it was negotiated, in fact, in Lancaster by the Sultan of Zanzibar, wanting the Muslims to be protected. But it's not for the Committee of Experts to make that sort of decision without knowing whether Christians are going to accept it or not, or whether the Muslim brothers and sisters are going to keep up a fuss. So there are certain policy, political decisions in respect of which people beyond, Kenyans beyond this, have got to be involved. And one doesn't quite see an overall coordinating sort of committee for these efforts by the various committees, by the various commissions. But I'm sure we'll get a way forward. I'm quite pleased to hear. I don't think there is a major difference between Mother Karua and myself. Even if we are to call the maximum, let's do it. But let's have those reforms in place now without waiting to resolve all these other issues. Because a referendum is also tricky in Kenya today, because you don't want the current polarization there is in the political class to find its way into the public being whipped to vote one way or the other during the referendum. But I think it is a necessary evil in the long run. I think if we could put in this package of reforms, call it maximum, call it minimum, somewhere along the road, in terms of ownership, and this is also the answer to the point raised by Mogoda from Kenya there. We need to give the Kenyan people ownership of this constitution. Because, you see, one of the problems with the independence constitution was the lack of ownership. You know, when Jomo came back and he went to Burma there and said, I've got the independence, and he was waving the Kenya constitution. That is how the very first amendment in 1964 by the Kenyatta regime converted a parliamentary system to a presidential system without reference to the Kenyan people. And there is also the major fundamental legal issue that parliaments are themselves creatures of the constitution. The constitution has to be above parliament. So we can't really have, unless we go through the route of a constituent assembly, there's something that does not resonate when you ask parliament to be the one to enact a new constitution, because then you are putting that parliament above the constitution. But I'm sure a way will be found. Greg, just to say, yes, these reformers are also to blame. They are scattered all over. While the conservatives, using the money they have accumulated from 1963, are very well organized and very focused, as opposed to the reformers. But somehow, the Kenyan people themselves have got to assume a greater sense of responsibility for their own destiny, rather than always waiting for a Messiah who turns out to be a hyena, being asked to look after sheep, which is really what is happening. An opportunity will arise. I think, and I'm sure Mother will agree with me here, I think one of our joys, those of us that you are talking about who are in that original movement, was the manner in which the Kenyan people are empowered, because they are not going to allow. I mean, you can increase the shooting, you can increase the repression, as indeed the current government has been doing when it has gone executing over 6,000 young men in Mount Kenya Central Region, extrajudicial execution. You can do all that. But there will be others lining up. People are very empowered, you know. The sort of thing that we are seeing on CNN about Iran. There comes a point where a leader has to give in, because you cannot shoot everybody. Who are you going to rule over if you do it that way? I just hope that this will be sooner than later. Thank you.
David Throop.
Honorable Karua and...
Please identify yourself. Please tell us who you are.
Oh, yes. My name is Andrew Nyemete. I'm from Kenya. Honorable Karua and Honorable Mwite, I want to thank you for a very wonderful presentation. Now, in listening to you, I conclude the following. Number one, reforms in Kenya are needed urgently. And number two, the window of opportunity to get those reforms is very short. We know that the elections are going to be held in 2012. That's only about, 30 months or 36 months away. And we know that things in Kenya usually go very slowly. Number three, you have mentioned that the powers that be right now are not interested in reforms. And so for me, if I were to change the title of the presentation today, I would say it's not so much that our reforms possible. The point is, reforms are possible and they are actually inevitable. The question for me is, do we have reformers? And I want to use the word new reformers, because the old reformers, as you said, have joined the system. Do we have reformers who can lead the process? And what are the strategies that can give us a constitution or a new Kenya in the shortest time possible? Hopefully before 2012. Let me give you a few examples.
Okay, I think you've asked the question, okay. And we have to give others a chance.
All right. Okay.
All right. David Throop, and then over here.
Thank you very much, it's good to see you at CSIS. David Throop from CSIS. I can't resist the temptation to correct the teenage Paul Mwiti's view of constitutional reform. If you actually look at the early constitutions of the early 1960s, What do you think Kenyan politics was about between 1960 and 1963? What do you think the 1961 election was about? What do you think the 1963 election was about? It was all about what kind of constitution do you Kenyans want? So to say that Lancaster House didn't have protracted discussion, it dominated the Kenyan press for 3 years. It dominated Kenyan political life. The fact that Jomo then tore it up and instituted the State House constitution is a decision of you Kenyans, not a constitution that we imposed on you at Lancaster House. So I would like to get rid of that myth. But my two questions are constitutional reform. It seems to me that maybe the two key questions are, how far are you going to devolve? I.e. Majimboism, are you going to have regional autonomy? Is President Moi, 1961, finally going to get what he wanted in terms of the old Kadu structure of government? And the second question I have is the provincial administration. Some would argue that the provincial administration is at the heart of the imperial presidency and needs to go, that you can't have a democratic Kenya with the provincial administration. Others would argue that take away the provincial administration and the whole structure of the Kenyan state would disintegrate almost overnight. Where do you stand on those two issues, provincial administration and Majimboism?
And I'd like to come in with a supplement on the question on devolution. Devolution, as described as Majimbo, has been the hot potato for, 40 years? And my supplemental question is, can't the issue be, shall we say, de-emotivized, more technocraticized, in that power can be devolved not to these large multi-ethnic units that have been the basis of the political debate, such as Rift Valley Province, but to relatively smaller units, as occurred in Nigeria over a period of years, so that the anathema of Majimbo to some, most particularly the political elite from Central Province, in fact is seen as an opportunity. And I have talked with several MPs from Central Province who have said just that. In fact, one said, I would love some measure of devolution. We will be the California, and they will be the Alabamas. So isn't it really a more complex issue than simply the old debate as seen by Moy? And, in fact, if you are going to devolve, doesn't the terms of reference, the historical terms of reference, need to change profoundly? On devolution, and then we'll come back to you, unless your question...
Now, maybe if we could begin with the devolution question. How far are we going to devolve? There is quite an amount of devolution going on even now in terms of the way the money is shared out and the decisions over that money, the constituency-based funds, which have increased tremendously with this budget. But the way I see it, we are unlikely to agree on regional autonomy. It's more administrative devolution, not regional autonomy. And there are those of us who think that we should actually have two houses of representatives, the National Assembly and the local assemblies. And one side of the divide was arguing during the last constitutional debate that the county councils should be the unit of devolution. For me, they need not be, but you can model local assemblies as the unit of devolution in a place where you redraw the boundaries and you bring several of them together. And then that way, you leave the National Assembly to handle policy and to be the watchdog, and the regional assembly to be the implementer. Right now, we are mixing things up. Members of Parliament are overseeing spending of their constituency development funds, leaving the country then without a watchdog over that spending. So it is possible. Whether we will be able to finalize this debate now is the big question. But even if we don't, so long as the opportunity for devolution principally is captured within the Constitution, then the details of that can be worked out in legislation, and that's what one would be looking forward to. Then there was a question of whether, by Nyamate, whether we have reformers. Yes, there are there, as Paul said, scattered, and it is a question of coalescing, having these pro-reform forces coalescing, and the strategy is to capture the mood of the masses on the issues where everybody agrees, the main issues for reform, and that way we would be able to attain the reforms that we need.
Let me begin with Andrew Nyamate. I agree entirely that time definitely could be running out, because even if we were to get a new constitution sometimes next year, that new constitution would create very many new structures. For example, if we sorted out the issue of devolution, clearly it rearrangement of the constitution, constituencies and what have you. So to operationalize that new constitution, in my view, would need to be given adequate time. And that time to even operationalize that new constitution, even if we were to get it, is perhaps running out, if the new elections in 2012 are going to be held on the basis of that new constitution. Is there, in fact, enough time to operationalize that new constitution to enable Kenya to have the 2012 elections on the basis of that new constitution? David, you must have been taking your notes when I was talking, so maybe you didn't quite understand the point I was making. I was making the point that the independence constitution given to us by the British was a good parliamentary constitution. The point I was making is that because of lack of ownership by the Kenyan people, the Jomo government was able to mutilate that constitution without any objection from the Kenyan people from 1964. I mean, you can't just turn a parliamentary system to presidential system without reference to the people. So all I'm saying is that we need to involve the people, and we need to agree on clauses in the new constitution that cannot be amended by parliament without a referendum, the cornerstones of the new constitution. So I wasn't sort of blaming the British, I was blaming ourselves. Devolution, we've had decades and decades of very centralized administration from State House, where patronage and ethnicity have been bywords. And therefore, even at Tarmac Road, it is the president who you say, because Mother Karua is now a rebel, that road you are constructing towards our area, don't construct it, take it somewhere else. And therefore, in the minds of the people, they can only benefit if one of their own is a president. It's like we have bought into this culture that we must get in there to eat, which is what we are saying has to be changed in restructuring the way we economically and socially administer Kenya. And that is the context in which this debate on devolution has got to be seen. It's about resources. It's about wanting to get as much as possible. You see, when Kenyans are debating about devolution, an equitable distribution, they just talk about how the ugali is going to be divided. They don't talk about where the unga to cook the ugali is going to come from, which is a more important issue in my view. And this is why I'm saying we need enough time to debate this issue of devolution and to develop a consensus. And I don't see us being able to agree that quickly on that issue. Maybe we will, but we need adequate time. It's not complicated. If it is broken down the way Joel Bakan is suggesting, you convince the people in Central Province, for example, that they are going to be the major winners. But there is a problem on how you are going to create those resources. Provincial administration, this is such a powerful tool that if Muheshimiwa Martha Karua becomes president tomorrow, I don't think we want to abolish it. So we need to abolish it before, in the process of when we are in the context of the new constitution. I mean, it's all very good if you are the president sitting in State House and you are able to know what David Thorpe is doing in some village in the remotest corner of the country, because there is a chief who will report to the DO, who will report to the DC, who will report to the PC. And all the departments of government are arranged that way. It's very, very oppressive. And if you are going to devolve government, we must do away with provincial administration and have government representatives on the local council. More or less what Uganda has done with those local councils, if only they could get rid of the man who has overstayed there now. Thank you.
My name is Hassan Shire. I'm from Kampala. I'm coordinating.
My apologies before you say that.
No problem. And I realize that I'm not a Washington crowd person. My hand was up, but the chair, Joel, and thank him for giving me this opportunity, could not recognize me. Maybe he was thinking what I'm going to say. I'm coordinating sub-regional program for the protection of human rights defenders called Eastern Horn of Africa Human Rights Defenders Network. And Kenya is also included. I just want to share with you, I ask you the question later. Since Macau is not around, maybe I will have 2 minutes to talk. One is the close observation of the coalition government on the 3rd and the 2nd of this month in Geneva, where two different delegations led by ministers came and could not agree a statement to answer as a state party concern to Mr. Allison's report. He dragged it on at the Intercontinental Hotel, where Karu knows very well, up to the last minute, whereby at one point they asked the secretariat to have two different slots of time instead of 5 minutes, 15 minutes, so that they can speak 7.5 hours each, making a contradictory statement. And then I just wondered, that lack of cohesion existing to react into a special procedure report. And one asking, that has to come from the cabinet, and the other one is asking, this is not a cabinet issue, it's only technical people at the Ministry of Justice and Foreign Ministry to react to those procedures whenever the government is about to respond. And now we are talking about a reform of that magnitude in a short period of time. And then we are seeing.
Could you ask the question?
Okay. My question is the misplacement of things now, like now with witness protection program, which I'm concerned because of human rights defenders. 30 of them now are outside the country and sought protection elsewhere from the country for the first time after the killing of the defenders. And that witness protection program was placed at the AG's report instead of the National Human Rights Commission. So how come, if I'm a human rights defender, will run to the police force to whom I was running from without making? So I just want to ask Krowa, what do you think now can even protect the conscious spirits of the society now on the street of Nairobi not to have retribution when they cooperate with the international mechanisms? Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. Steve McDonald. And then in the back on the left.
Hi, Steve McDonald with the Woodrow Wilson International Center's Africa program. I just wanted to ask for a little expansion on a point that both of you touched on and that really relates to one of the points that our Kenyan colleague in the back made, and to the issue of is time running out on reform in terms of the 2012 elections and or whenever the elections may be held. Some people are calling for them to be earlier. In my recent visit to Kenya a couple of weeks ago when I had the chance to meet you, Honorable Karua, I was very struck by the levels of violence. You talked to Honorable Mwite about the Mount Kenya region and the troubles there that are ongoing. Honorable Karua talked about how the violence was just not around the elections, but had been going since, and the growth of the extortion gangs and all that's going on. It seems to me that this is becoming such an endemic and almost non-political thing now from all the feedback we were getting from civil society organizations that are working on these issues. The youth gangs might have been creations of political leaders who were trying to manipulate a process, but now they seem to have taken on a life of their own, and the violence is very endemic. Do you see this as something that could indeed explode and preempt the whole process of reform that's ongoing?
Can you elaborate on that? You mean sort of nihilistic violence or mafias and shakedowns?
All of the above. mafias and shakedowns, those probably the main thing I'm focused on. I mean, we were told by a lot of people that in the Central Province, if you are going to have your daughter married, or you're going to buy a plot of land to put a house, or you're running a taxi, that the need to pay off some of these mafia youth gangs, and not just Mungiki, is prevalent everywhere now. And if you don't, then you're probably killed. And that's going on everywhere.
Any other questions on specifically on the sort of law and order issue, the police that Honorable Karua had mentioned earlier in her talk but has been set aside until now? All right, then let's turn to that issue, and then we'll proceed with the others who have had their hands raised.
I'll say it's in some sections of Central Province, not everywhere, but in most regions, there are criminal gangs that become very active around the election time, whether it is Nyanza, whether it is the Rift Valley, where it is the youth who were committing most acts of violence at the behest of politicians. It's only that in Central Province, during the 2002 general elections, the Moi government contracted one of those groups to campaign for Moi's preferred candidate. So an illegal group became adopted by the state machinery and was facilitated. The scene of the Kibaki era is that when we came in, we did not factor these phenomena and try to deal with those groupings then. The groupings have grown and have their own areas of influence all over the country. Last year, the government had to mount an operation in Mount Elgon. It was not purely a political group. It was about land, but it also had acquired a political dimension. So what I'm saying is that a near breakdown of law and order. And what's more is that when these extortion gangs are going on with their activities, they do it sometimes in league with the police, because there's no way you can collect illegal taxes in a large area without the police, the administration in the area, and the intelligence picking it up. But somehow they do nothing, which means that some of them are on payroll of these gangs. That's why police reforms are so critical. And also some thinking is needed on how to otherwise engage the youth. We are having a youth explosion where so many are unemployed. Unemployment is above 40%. I think that, like Paul said, certain reforms can be done, but it would be expecting too much to expect that during the remaining short time, even a willing government can be able to overcome all that. But if we open the doors for the reforms by enacting a new constitution and setting at least some order before the elections, then the government that comes in, and it must be a reform government for the country to survive, can deepen those reforms. The government, the rogue police, have also had a persecution policy to persecute every male youth from the Mount Kenya community. Anybody is on site labeled a member of the criminal gang. Majority of those who are arrested are not taken to court. The police extort money from them. and then release them. A few are taken to court for the offense of touting and or belonging to the illegal gang, because some members of the gang are touts on public service vehicles. So they charge them with touting and or belonging to the gang. And we are saying this persecution of a whole generation must also stop. Arrest individuals by their names and by the crime they have committed, but don't generalize and persecute everybody. And persecution is not new in Kenya. In 1963, after independence, members of the Somali community were being persecuted and labeled shifter, which was the word for the rebel movement there. This time, it is mainly the Kikuyu, because the young men being arrested mainly are Kikuyu, and the label is Mungiki. And those are the people affected most by the extrajudicial killings. I would not think that it is so deep that it cannot be uprooted, but some work will be needed.
Could you perhaps pick up on a point that Paul Mwite made in his reference to Mungiki, that this is a, shall we say, the continuation 40 years later of some of the original divisions that were laid bare during the run-up to independence. Do you see it the same way? And if not, what are the divisions within the Kikuyu community that are at play here?
I think the whole issue is the divide between the rich and the poor. And the extremely wealthy are not many. It is majority who are the poor. And this group started in the Rift Valley in the early 90s when there were politically engineered tribal clashes around the elections in an attempt to evict the Kikuyus from the Rift Valley. So it actually started as a group organizing to defend when they are attacked. It has mutated to a criminal gang. It was then utilized by the regime to assist them in the 1992 elections, that is the Moi regime, and the Kibaki regime has done nothing to contain them. And there are politicians who still rely on them during the election time. I think what we must realize, away from giving people tags, is that unless something is done to bridge the poverty gap, to address issues of social justice, whatever tags we give youths from different parts of the country, the problem is with us. And it's time we reviewed issues of social justice and ensure that everybody has a place in the country. We have people owning 300 to 500 acres in Nairobi, the capital city, when we know that close to a million people are living on 10 acres of land known as Kibera. I don't think we have to look for tags and ethnic titles to these youths. We have to address the problem and give people a chance in life. It's an issue of social exclusion, and it's everywhere.
Let me just comment on the two delegations, the point that was raised by my friend from Kampala. It's really a demonstration of a point I had made earlier as a challenge to the realization of a new constitution, the political polarization, because that's a fact. Number two, it is a fact that there are well-documented cases of extrajudicial executions, and therefore, when one side of the government was preparing a paper and calling Professor Olson names, the other side that may not have been involved to the same extent felt they had to travel to Geneva to state that they were supporting Professor Olson's report. And I can tell you, if you are to carry out a referendum, Professor Olson's report, you get 90% support from the Kenyan people. Maybe 98%, because it's a fact, these extrajudicial executions. Witness protection, it's there because the legislation went through. But without money, I know for a fact, because I talked to the person who is the acting director in charge of the witness protection unit, and the point is that they have no money to give that protection. They're in the process of operationalizing the act, of training people. It's a very expensive affair. I think it's receiving a lot of donor support. But as of now, it is not a reality in practical terms. Steve and Joel, without breaching counsel-client confidentiality, because I'm leading in the defense of the so-called leader of this gang, and therefore I know a lot of the inside information. The reality is this, that there is unfinished business in Central Province between the loyalists who took over all the wealth and who have been in power, and the Mau Mau. This is the fourth generation of people who feel aggrieved, who feel betrayed, and who feel very bitter even today with the poverty, with unemployment, in the face of this very conspicuous consumption and accumulation. And therefore, the potential in Central Province for fairly unpleasant confrontations is there, combined with the decay of the state in certain respects. If you go to Mathare Valley, there is no government. So it is these young people who constitute the government. They are the ones who keep law and order in those slum areas. There is no government. When you go to the transport industry, the police themselves are extorting, and they don't even hide collecting money from every bus, from every matatu. They are not providing any services. The Mogiki are providing services because they say, no, you keep your place in the queue and do this, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complex situation. And anybody who thinks that Mungiki is a law and order issue, period, is missing the point. It's an economic, social issue. The law and order aspect may be 30%. But if this is not realized and therefore the correct strategy is adopted, you can kill 10,000, there will be another 20,000 coming up and joining the movement. It's not pleasant. Certainly they extort. But now, when the police come up with the strategies of authorizing criminal gangs and providing logistical support and intelligence, and even paying them to carry out executions on behalf of the police in the name of fighting Mungiki, I mean, how do you tell who is criminal and who is not criminal? I mean, that only escalates violence from both sides. It's a very dangerous situation. In Madakaroa's own area, in Kirinyaga district, the police have recruited vigilantes who they are paying to go and carry out executions because they think it's going to embarrass the Honorable Madakaroa. And because they don't want to carry out the executions in case Professor Austin comes back or sends somebody else. So now they recruit these vigilantes and they pretend that it is the community which is uprising because they don't want money extorted from them. Why don't they arrest these individuals who are extorting money instead of setting out criminal gangs and actually guiding them to people's homes to go and carry out, pull out young men who are taken to a field nicknamed appropriately The Hague, where they are tried within 15 minutes and executed in the presence of the police? Is this a way to fight crime? Is this a way to fight law and order?
Okay, you have been patiently waiting, and I thought you had left and run out of patience, but...
Thank you very much. Is it on? Okay. Lawrence Freeman from Executive Intelligence Review African Desk. Both speakers and also Mr. Barkin mentioned the ICC, International Criminal Court. Personally, I'm opposed to the ICC. I don't think an international court has the right to infringe on a nation's sovereignty. But I wanted to know from yourselves Under what conditions do you think the ICC would make actions against leaders in Kenya? And what effect do you think this will have on Kenya? Sort of connected to that a little bit is there are people in Washington who have said that Kenya is very close to sliding down a slippery slope into ungovernability or chaos. And I wanted to know your evaluation on is that accurate?
Thank you. Wanjiru Kamau is my name. And I'm very glad to be able to listen to our distinguished guest this afternoon. Mine is related to the youth. And I'm wondering what is your strategy in involving the youth in the reforms you're talking about? Already the current ambassador, American ambassador, I'm reading he's going around meeting with the youth and telling them what they need to do because no one is doing anything about the constitutional reforms. You just talked about the youth and employment. And while I was in Kenya in December, the ethnic radios, everybody seems to know what is going on. When you listen to them in vernacular, they know. Everybody is aware of what is going on. So my question is, is there anything you two can do? You are one of you is my heroine, the other one my hero. Is there anything you can do to actually involve and engage our youth in a dialogue in what you're trying to say? Because I've lived through Kenyatta, I've lived through Moi, I'm living through Kibaki, I've had it all. And I'm saying, can we get the youth involved? Thank you.
Thank you. I am Mwangi Kimenyi of the Brookings Institution, 1 month. Before that, I was the director of KIPRA in Kenya. I would like to make very brief comments, but question. Number one, we see parliament, or we have seen parliament as the institution of change or the agent. But we learned recently, and we were talking with David, that Kenyan MPs are the most highly paid in the world, and the campaigns are also very expensive. Now, obviously, you don't attract the best in parliament, and the moment someone goes to parliament is going to look for the money they paid to recover through the campaigns. So the question is, can we expect the parliament of Kenya really to be an agent of change? Can we rely on parliament to institute these reforms? And in fact, wouldn't it be true to say that the whole system, although you talked about the older people, the people who own land, isn't the parliament actually itself a real institution that is corrupt just by the fact that they are paid many, many times more than any other place in the world? Footnotes. We did a survey on what people understand about Majibo before the elections. Most people think that Majibo, for example, if you're in the Rift Valley, Majibo means that the people who are not born there will go back to their own places. People who own resources, or for example, at the coast, who think that they should control tourism, think that the Majibo means that you control your own resources. So the idea that we rejected, or people rejected, the constitution on the basis of Majibo is because we don't have good education, and I didn't hear you sort of talk about is it a knowledge gap that we are dealing with here. And finally, I don't think we should expect coalition governments to make tough decisions. We don't know any place where coalition governments make tough decisions.
So what is your question? Is it just
I talk comments about the Kenyan parliament and the pay.
Rachel Brown, and I'm an intern at Global Financial Integrity. This is sort of piggybacking on the question about the Kenyan parliament. First of all, thank you for your remarks. I also think that you both have a very unique perspective from the inside of parliament I think that what we've heard is that some of the major barriers to reform are the individuals in Parliament with personal interests that go against reform, against decreasing corruption and things like that. I was wondering, as stability in Kenya seems to be decreasing, violence from Mungiki spreading, things like the railroad being dug up in Kibera, and people seem very angry over a lot of the scandals that have broken recently, like the maize scandal, is there any recognition among members of Parliament and politicians in Kenya that perhaps their actions and the corruption they engage in are contributing to decreased stability in Kenya, that a corrupt police force, a corrupt military maybe puts them in danger as well? What is the mindset of these politicians, and how can the people of Kenya put pressure on these politicians to actually change and sort of make them feel at risk for not engaging in reform?
I would be remiss if I didn't talk about the IDPs, since that seemed like it has not been a part of the discussion today. And with the IDP situation, I understand that 650,000 people were displaced and 350,000 are still without accommodations. And the IDP situation goes back to 1992. Sounds like the same time you all came to the parliament. But the second question is that will the Constitution speak to the redistribution of the land? Because it seems like the majority tribe, I don't want to call no tribal names, owns 87% of the land. Same thing we have found in South Africa. So how do you, is the Constitution speaking to the redistribution of the land? And what about the IDPs that are still on the ground in Kenya?
Let's hear the response to that, and then we'll probably wrap it up, although I have a final question in terms of polling on this whole question of the Constitution. So, Paul?
Yeah, okay. Can I start with the question on the ICC? And really, there are two issues there. And the first one is that ICC, the International Criminal Court, can focus on the post-election violence, the WACI envelope, investigate the individuals who are named in that envelope, and probably institute proceedings where there is sufficient evidence, even against one or two. But it is critical that that envelope now be added to the International Criminal Court. The second issue on which the International Criminal Court can legitimately take a mandate is in respect of extrajudicial executions. And this one is even simpler, more straightforward, because the NGOs have done a wonderful job in documenting specific cases. They've got the evidence, they've got the relatives, and that is fairly straightforward. But again, it's not so much the execution squads. The more important question for the International Criminal Court is those who are in power and who formulated this policy and who allow the squads to go around carrying out the extrajudicial executions. Wajiro, I don't have any ready answer other than to say that I, and I'm sure Mother will do the same, will continue to demand that the youth should be involved. I think the tragedy is that the youth are only involved during elections by the political actors who pay the money to go and carry out certain actions. But I'd like to make the comment that the solution to the youth problem should be put in context, in the wider context of rearranging the manner in which we manage our socio-economic situation in the country. You need to expand the whole economy so that the youth can naturally be absorbed in the formal economy. Because now when you come up with the piecemeal sort of policies say to be targeting the youth, with the endemic corruption that we have, even that money gets stolen somewhere along the way. So the solution to the youth problem also lies in the wider issue of a solution to the Kenyan problem. But you are quite right that they should not be forgotten. Kemenyi, I agree with you, then, and that's the point I was making. I mean, don't ask the Grand Coalition government to implement Agenda 4. Doesn't have the capacity. It will not do so. It will always take the soft options out. You are quite bang on. And on Majibo, it's not actually a knowledge gap. That represents the reality. The people in Coast Province believe Coast Province is from Mijikenda. And their concept of Majibo is that the day we introduce Majibo, kila mtu wambara aende nyumbani. And that's why I say this issue needs to be approached very, very, with a lot of circumspection. And I'm not sure that it is an issue we can resolve before the next elections. Parliament, can it be an agent for change? I think the positive aspect is that if you look back through the history of constitutional agitation, constitutional reform, it has never been initiated by Parliament. It's always come from without, and Parliament is sort of forced to act. And even now, the role of the civil society, the Kenyan people, the organized sectors of the civil society, like the religious sector, they need to bring pressure. And I think Honorable Martha Karua had made that point. If you leave Parliament, it will not move on its own. It is pressure. And the pressure is not just on Parliament, it's on the two principals, the Prime Minister and the President. Rachel, you talk about the instability and the threat, the potential instability. It is very, very real. We keep saying that Kenya is at crossroads, but in my own assessment, this is the real, genuine crossroad. We take one turn to the wrong direction, and Somalia, Rwanda, Uganda is going to be like a piece of cake. Yeah, we saw a bit of it in December, January, following the elections. It's a very, very serious situation. And there is complete sense, there is a complete disconnect between the leaders and the people. In fact, my sense of it is that if this violence had continued for another 2-3 weeks, because initially it was purely ethnic, but from what I was gathering in Madare Valley and in other areas, the different youths from different communities, the sense, the penny was beginning to drop, and they were asking, why are we fighting, you, Oduor, and me, this Kisi? Why are we fighting? Our enemies are the ones in Mudhaiga. So it's going to become a class issue. Next time there is an implosion, it will be a class issue. It will not be an ethnic issue. And that really could be the head of the Kenya we know. And we don't want that to happen. This is why we are saying we must have this package of reforms to create a valve where elections can be held, and so that hopefully those elections can usher in a reformist government with the mandate and the legitimacy to implement Agenda 4, including addressing the injustices of the past. Are you going to redistribute land and the IDP? Again, this is one of the issues, and I hope you get the opportunity of going through my remarks here, because land issue is so very, very sensitive in Kenya. In fact, if you had asked that question in Nairobi in the presence of some Kikuyus, they would have wanted to know where you come from. And let me tell you, my friend, my dear friend, James Orengo, is the Minister for Land. And he went in with a lot of vigor about the land policy, and that involves land ownership, land use, and that sort of thing, implementation of the land policy, implementation of the very good report by Dongo, the Dongo Commission report. And in those initial stages after the accord at Serena, even President Kibaki was praising Orengo on the floor of parliament. He said Orengo alone can write this new constitution. You know, I think he had a soft spot for Orengo at that particular moment in time. Sometimes later in State House, I think after a cabinet meeting, same president is pulling Orengo aside. Hii mambo ya hadi unaongea ongea, hiyo wacha. He pulled Orengo aside. And this is the president. He's saying, these affairs of land you're always talking about, stop it. Stop. So it's a very, very delicate issue, very complex. It has to be resolved if you are going to have a new constitution, if you are going to have stability. But you can't rush it. I mean, it's so very contentious. You simply can't rush it. And IDPs, it's a national shame. They are still there. In fact, those who have attempted to be resettled in their original homes are in some ways worse off than those in refugee camps. Because those who are in refugee camps at least are being fed. The Red Cross is there. People are going there. When you get returned to your own home, there's nobody, you know, coming to give you food, and you still haven't grown your own crops. You still feel vulnerable. During the recent memorial at Kiambaa Church in Rift Valley, as soon as the president was about to wind up his speech, the Kikuyu started running away, leaving the president winding up his speech. Why? Because they felt that we've gathered here, we are all Kikuyus. The president, you get into his car to go and get the plane and go back, we can be surrounded. It's very dangerous. So they didn't want to be left there. They wanted to disappear even before the president had finished the address. So it's still a very delicate situation. The tragedy is the disconnect between the leaders and the people.
May I begin with that IDP issue? The reason that they have not been resettled is, again, an issue of governance. Funds set aside, they may not have been adequate, but they could have removed everybody from the camp. But the money went into wrong hands. Lists are done, and money is pocketed. And it has taken the government a very long time to admit there is a problem in the distribution. They had resorted to getting police to forcibly evict the IDPs to nowhere. So now there is a rethink, and money has again been provided in the budget. But with the current setup, it is unlikely to be of real benefit to the IDPs. So corruption is affecting the way in which every sector of government achieves the objectives. Now, why we would invite the ICC, according to international law, they come to punish international crimes where the government is unwilling or unable. The government of Kenya has demonstrated that it's unable. So they ought to move in, but like I said before, that would only be for the top-level offenders, for the international crimes. We still will need our own mechanism to uphold the rule of law as far as the national crimes are concerned. About the youth, may I say that the only place where the ambassador of the U.S. to Kenya is moving about is in the Rift Valley, which was the epicenter of the clashes during the post-election violence. It is true that members of parliament from those areas and also other national leaders like the president and the prime minister have not really returned there to reconcile the people. So there is a gap. And I think what the U.S. ambassador is doing is good because it provokes those people in those areas to realize and to remember that there is unfinished business. But we are not saying as leaders that that belongs to them only. We are also doing what we can to go around as political parties, as individual leaders, to tell these youth and the people what they already know. That the problem is not ethnicity, is the manner in which they are governed. The question has also been asked whether there is a knowledge gap. Yes, there is a knowledge gap, and that works to fund negative ethnicity. If it is the Coast Province or the Rift Valley, where the people assume that either the Kikuyu or this and that tribe has taken their land, the tribe that has taken land is the tribe of those who have been in power and close to power, and they belong to all ethnic communities. The big land owners are from every ethnic community, and they are very, very few. When the fighting comes over the land, it is the poor evicting the poor. Even in the Rift Valley, the big farms of people from the various ethnic communities were never touched. The big farms of the third generation white settlers were never touched. So it's as though those owning land belong to their own tribe. And this is the realization the people have to see, that even if you evicted all the poor people, the total land you would recover is so insignificant, it would not solve the problem. If we needed redistribution, then we have to go to the heart of the matter. That knowledge gap has to be worked on so that people can be rational when they discuss these issues. And there are many, many other examples one can give of that knowledge gap. And I believe the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission is a forum where the nation will dialogue with itself. It's not a perfect forum, and it will not cure everything, but it will provide a mechanism where people can hear different perspectives from different people. And it is up to us who are active in politics to ensure that we encourage people who will give these positive insights to come before the Truth, Justice and Reconciliation Commission so that facts may come out. Remember that the history that is being read in our schools is history from the lens of the colonizer. So the young person in the Rift Valley will not know the history of the migration there, the person at the coast. So there are many, many knowledge gaps, and it is a challenge that we, in those who are in a position to influence the politics and to influence the information that gets to the people, we really must do our best to ensure that the information is available. Now, the other question is about Parliament. I have been in four parliaments. This is the most educated, most youthful, the worst I have been in. I call it the greatest auction house in Africa, and I've said so even in Parliament. I think that we really will have to do a lot. Parliament itself is in dire need of reform, but Parliament at least can be ejected by the people. Last Parliament, 70% were voted out. I hope this time we get really annihilated, because we will be deserving it. But it is an institution that requires reform, but I never lose hope even in such situations. There are people who still are redeemable and can be galvanized together to do something. And there are various groups trying to do something, whether it's about the youth in their constituencies, in a bid to influence government to adopt positive policies towards the youth. And I think joining with reform forces outside Parliament, something concrete can be done. In 1997, when the outside was pushing us to reform, we joined in Parliament to form the Inter-Parties Parliamentary Group, popularly known as IPPG. There were constitutional amendments made. They may not have been adequate, but that is what has really opened the space for the reforms that have so far gone in the country. So it is possible, even in a largely anti-reform parliament, in moments of crisis, to get people to do something. And these are the opportunities that are being explored. Finally, ethnic-based politics. I think it's politicians who use negative ethnicity. And this is the time also for parties. In view of the Political Parties Act, which was enacted in 2007 and which became operational last year, to make Kenya truly adopt issue-based politics where people coalesce on ideals and also embrace competitive politics rather than patronage. Also to manage our parties and as institutions, not as something wholly owned by those who are leading it. Unfortunately, the application of the Political Parties Act has not been as is expected, but those of us in the political arena are trying to change the political landscape by again taking the debate to the people. So there has to be many initiatives by the people to try and transform our country, and we just can't afford to give up on it, difficult as it looks.
I think on that hopeful note, I will bring a very sobering discussion to conclusion. I'm actually very disappointed that Professor Makau Matua could not be here, particularly when I received a note that his plane landed about an hour ago, but evidently he's encountered other difficulties. Thank you very much for traveling here to spend a rich 2 hours with us.